there are some significant challenges there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know?
So, Steve, let me interview you. Tell me, where did you go, and how long were you there for to begin with?
Steve Sherlock here for Franklin Matters, Franklin Public Radio, anywhere on the internet, WFPR.FM, and in the local Franklin, Mass. FM radio dial 102.9. Here in studio again with my friend Ted McIntyre. Ted, happy Tuesday. How are you doing today?
I am doing very well. Happy to be here, Steve. This is great to see you again.
Absolutely, since it's been a bit, and this is now our 39th episode. Amazing.
It is remarkable.
And we got a bunch to talk about today.
Oh boy, do we.
For the listeners' benefit, yes, I've been away for a bit. I was fortunate to have taken a trip to Uganda. Yes. Halfway around the world, it seems. 2 9-hour flights. We got there. We got back. Lots of stories, and some of which are climate related, and that's what we'll talk about today.
Yeah. I mean, it's number one, remarkable to have the experience of going to some place so different from at least my everyday existence, right?
Anybody in the U.S., yes. It is definitely another world.
Another world. And I think that we will just talk. There's no, I don't have any great particular insights, but yeah, I think all these things can be seen or have implications for the climate issue that we talk about. And I think that it's important to integrate those observations, in a sense, normalize that. So we see things through this lens, and that's just another way to interpret what has sounded like a fantastically magical experience for you.
It was definitely a magical experience. Lots of lessons learned, some of which we'll touch on here, some of which will be coming out as we go. I think I mentioned along the way offline, I'll mention here, there were at least in excess of 3,000 items of video and photo. So I've got a wealth of images to share. But pertinent, at least, to where we were going. Clearly, for the listeners' sake, yes, we were making sense of climate. So Ted is my guide to help me make sense of climate. And that, I think, is going to be one of those extemporaneous exercises in just that. Because while we've been talking about the climate guidelines, the roadmap, certainly the UN has stuff, the US has stuff, Mass itself has a roadmap. And whether we're on it or not, whether the departments are coordinating or not, now that I've gone and seen the other side, so to speak, there are some significant challenges there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know?
So, Steve, let me interview you. Tell me, where did you go, and how long were you there for to begin with?
We left the 21st. Excuse me. We left February 1st, returned late the 20th. I really, we were here the 21st.
Basically 3 weeks.
It took a full day transit, 2 flights, 9 hours with some delays, et cetera, waiting, et cetera. But yeah.
And you went into Uganda, yeah, into the capital would begin in a place called Kampala. Is that
Kampala?
The...
Yeah. So we landed in Entebbe. And okay. For those of a certain age, of our age, we remember that, oh, wait a minute, 1976, the year I was graduating from college, there was an Olympics later that year. Israel and Israeli armed forces rescued 100-something hostages who had been on a flight out of someplace in the Middle East, in the Mediterranean. They ended up making a couple of stops and then ended up at Entebbe Airport.
Because they were taken hostage somewhere.
They were hostage.
Right.
PLO, Yasser Arafat, those names, of which, I mean, things haven't really changed to a certain extent because the Palestinian-Israeli thing is still going on with Gaza and there's a whole bunch of horrifics there. Things haven't changed much. So,
but
yet.
It was Entebbe that you flew into, went to Kampala, and then the plan was to do what? To jet ski on Lake Victoria?
No, it was purely...
Kampala is on Lake Victoria, which is...
It's like, north of Lake Victoria.
It's northern.
Yeah, and Tembe is specifically bordering the lake. And Lake Victoria is one of the major lakes in Africa, Central Africa, it's specifically. Kampala is more north of that. So I think it was like a 45-minute, almost an hour ride from Entebbe into Kampala. We arrived at night. We left at night. So I really didn't see much of Entebbe at all, other than they've got a bright, brand-new terminal that just opened, coincidentally, in January of this year.
And so the Kampala part, you met someone in the what? They took you on a tour.
Yeah, so we had arranged through good friends of ours. There were five total in our party. We had a guide and a driver. So they picked us up at the airport, took us into our original hotel in Kampala, spent a day or so there kind of acclimating, getting adjusted to the time zones, the change, the new world we're in. And then we began kind of a counterclockwise, if you look at the map of Uganda, counterclockwise trip around the country.
And just Uganda, I looked it up moments ago, it is Central Africa sort of on the eastern side, which would be sort of the right-hand side as you look at a map of Africa.
Yep.
Landlocked. And surrounded by other countries.
Yep.
And you were doing now what amounts to a counterclock. How big is Uganda?
Uganda is fairly large. So in perspective, as a native Rhode Islander, I always used, I mean, Rhode Island's tiny, we know that. But it, you know, still takes an hour to go from corner to corner of Rhode Island. 100 Rhode Islands fit within Uganda. 100, not 99, 100. 11 Commonwealths of Massachusetts fit within Uganda. So it is fairly good size.
Well, I think that portrays the other side of the coin is that Africa is an enormous continent.
Yeah.
And when you look at it, again, Uganda seems like a, you know, one more postage stamp on a whole bunch of other countries that are of comparable size.
Right.
So
it's...
Right. As a continent, it's enormous.
It's enormous, and there's actually evidence out there, and there's websites we can go to that eventually at some point. It's not purpose here, but the common depiction of Africa on the map misstates its size. It is significantly bigger than what is shown on the average map.
So, Steve, that's what I love about you, because I was thinking the same thing, is that every map that you've grown up with is a mathematical problem because the mathematician, the idea of translating, literally mapping a point on a sphere, which is what the globe is, onto a flat piece of paper is a problem. And the way they solve it is by taking the North Pole and putting it along the whole line at the top of the map. And the South Pole is the whole line at the bottom of the map.
Yep.
And that's why when you look at one of these maps, Greenland, which is tiny, looks bigger than Africa just because of the way the distortion of the mapping from the global, the circular thing to the flat thing. So, yeah, I mean, if you had a... Not just one other thing. It's like every map you've ever seen has the United States at the center. Every world map has the U.S. I've seen maps that are centered on Australia, upside down and backwards, right?
Unless you go back into, you know, the European world when France and England and Spain, et cetera, were the dominant countries and look at those maps. Most of the modern maps have the U.S. in the center, and it's a distorted view of the world, but it's our world view.
And you could easily imagine a map equally valid that centers Africa, which would make it look proportionately, you know, much bigger landmass, just again because of this mapping issue.
Yeah.
So Africa's pretty big.
And
from a climate perspective, there's tons of different environments and different ways that climate will impact Africa. So it's very hard to be specific and say, oh, this one location represents everything that could happen there.
Mm-hmm.
Because you go from the Sahara in the north, the Cape Town in the south, to the coast, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah,
so Africa's a big continent.
It's a big place. So if you look at Africa as a whole, one of the things they talk of Uganda as being the pearl of Africa, which in a couple of ways, the analogy, at least as I understand, since I understand now more of why they call it the pearl. the pearl generally is grown by an oyster in the center as an irritation and a response to the irritation. Mm-hmm. So to a certain extent, there's, and that's part of the mindset of the Uganda folk, who, while they were a protectorate of the British Commonwealth, they were not a colony. They were a protectorate. So they have been very holding on to their own determination. Whether you call it freedom or not, it's their own determination. They have been in charge. They were protected by Great Britain in its Commonwealth days, and then they separated. There's a big Independence Day celebration, et cetera, and then they've gone through some management changes, different regimes. One notably, Idi Amin, had a horrific period of time, at least from our knowledge, based on what we heard, et cetera, and yet the two individuals who are our guide and driver, respectfully, they were 20-something, early 30s. They remember Idi as having created stuff that lasts. So whatever roads and or buildings they did under his guidance, they're staying through. And putting aside kind of the horrific stuff he did, which he was also involved in the raid, he was presumably negotiating on both sides, but mm-hmm. some of his soldiers actually were fighting against the Israelis, etc. So that's a separate piece, but I just, they didn't necessarily remember that. They remembered that he made stuff that lasted.
Well, I think the content, yeah, it is, Steve, I think that the historical knowledge that people carry and retain is a fascinating topic. Mm-hmm.
Oh, sure.
Comment I was going to make was that you mentioned a protectorate, and we will come back, I think, to the idea of colonialism and how colonialism is playing out today and what it means.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
there's lots and lots of links to this.
Absolutely.
Discussion.
Sure.
So you're not, when you're touring, your guides bringing you around, was it to national parks or was it?
Yeah, there are 10 national parks in Uganda. There are other, you know, natural resource places similar to our park system. There's different forests and et cetera. But of the 10 national parks, we scheduled in our routes to visit 7 of them. So we did cover the major ones. We got up into that far corner, and that far corner, again, Africa is fairly big, but this is the sub-Sahara part. So the Sahara Desert really comes across that top third, roughly. And then this is kind of the green underneath. So mm-hmm. that upper right corner closer to Kenya, that's the savanna. So if you think of kind of the Lion King in their depiction, it's the broad open plains with the isolated acacia trees, etc. That's pretty much there.
Mm-hmm.
So we did get to see giraffes and water buffaloes and elephants, et cetera, on the safari drives when we did that part. We drove down through a couple of other Murchison National Park, and then ultimately to Bwendi Impenetrable Forest. The name is important. It is truly an impenetrable forest. That was where we went gorilla tracking. And the gorilla is a little bit in terms of both our protection of them. Mm-hmm. They only let groups of up to 10 at a time go into the woods, forest, and spend no more than an hour in their presence. And in their presence, I mean, not much farther apart than you or I is sitting right now in the studio.
Really?
We were that close to some of the gorillas.
Wow.
It was just an awesome experience.
Wow.
It was hard to get to because the impenetrable piece. So the gorillas, which for whatever their own reasons are, they'll nest. And because they eat 25 kilograms, and I haven't done the math, but it's a whole lot of vegetation, which when it goes in is going to come out. And they don't stay in the same place two nights in a row because what they've deposited on the ground is a mess. Mm-hmm. So they move and make another camp. and then move and make another camp. So they don't stay in the same place each day. So the trackers know where they were that day. They stay and find out where they're going to stay that night. And then the next morning, they go to that spot, check kind of in a forensics piece, okay, where did they go? Mm-hmm. What did they do while they were there? Are there any issues? You know, was there any blood? Did somebody have any fights? Or was a mother giving birth? Or, you know, some of those type things. Then they find out where they're moving to. And then they start communicating with the guides who are taking us kind of down this steep slope, following the guys with the machetes, hacking our way through to the impenetrable forest for a reason, to get up close and spend to an hour with them, enjoy their presence. We're masked to protect them from anything we may be carrying.
Wow. So you are 10 feet away from an adult male, I mean, gorilla is a funny word, right?
Silverback mountain gorilla.
Mountain gorilla.
Yeah, as opposed to a land gorilla, this is a mountain back gorilla.
So this is a sort of the classic image. So here's my question. You've been there. You've had this, I can only imagine, profound experience of being that close to a species similar to mankind, but
yes.
Sufficiently different.
Yes.
Okay. And you say to yourself, this species could be lost because of climate change, right? Where does that put you?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how do you put those two and two? I guess the question is, having that kind of a experience of the long term continuity of life, and say, oh, we're doing this stuff that would threaten that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and it's interesting on a couple of aspects. So I'll try and keep them in order, so to speak, although there's not really a defined order, just I want to make sure I cover all the points. But the impenetrable forest, effectively, as I vision it, it's kind of a ring. So there's a circular form of mountain around, and the impenetrable forest is kind of in the center. And it's not exactly that, because it really bleeds into the Republic of Congo, and it bleeds into Rwanda as well. But outside that circle, the other side of the mountain are terraced farmland. So the people are living in a hardscrabble agrarian-based life. On the other side of the mountain is this impenetrable forest where the gorillas are managing to, you know, continue to multiply, etc. There are some estimates that a few years ago there was like 300, now there's like 600 to 700. Exactly how it's going to go, the birth rate, a mother will give birth, nurse for a couple of years, and then be ready. So every 4 or 5 years, a mother will give birth. And they don't give birth to twins. Or if they do, one of the twins don't survive. So they're not multiplying rapidly. So, yeah, they are kind of on the edge. And that's why they're trying to be mindful of, you know, providing a tourist opportunity. Because the country certainly needs revenue. We'll get into that at some point. But also protecting them. So they're only bringing the group in for a little bit at a time to try and just, you know, disrupt them a little bit, mm-hmm. as minimal as possible. Mm-hmm. It's awesome.
I think the awesome, the point I keep coming back to is the awesome nature of the experience connects us to the awesomeness of the planet that we're screwing around with. Somehow
there's a fine line between that. And it was one of the pieces that, you know, the guides, to their knowledge, and they've studied, you know, between the gorillas and the chimps, etc. So I think the gorillas, if I remember correctly, it's like 99.6% match to us as humans. The one significant difference is while they have hands and fingers, et cetera, their feet are much more flexible than ours. Ours are relatively flat-footed, whereas if you look at a gorilla's foot, they can really kind of curl almost like they've got four hands, mm-hmm. but their feet, right? Chimps are like a percent more closer match to us. I did not know that. It was something we learned along the way. It was like, really? Oh, okay. And wow. trekking to get to close with the chimpanzees, and there was a group of about 20 or so, and ultimately at some point in time, some of the video and photos will make it their way out publicly, so you'll be able to see as opposed to just imagining. So we go walking through the forest, not quite as steep, much more of a gentle path, although it's still kind of hacking through it. And then there's a walkway, and literally a boardwalk to protect the path above, you know, the vegetation, which we do boardwalks at Delcarte and other places for valid reasons. Some of the monkeys had just, and they were just sitting, chilling, grooming each other, picking off, you know, the stuff, grooming, etc. There was like 15, 20 of them on the boardwalk, mingling. Others were coming up. There was one that had approached us from behind. He was carrying kind of a big, long stick, and we weren't sure, based on the conversations with our guards, whether he was doing that as defensive motion because he was fearful of us to that extent. He ended up trying to get by us, and his stick got caught in a branch or a vine. So one end of the stick bumped my leg. He dropped the stick and then bumped the person in front of me and then get up on the boardwalk and joined the others, and it just, you know, continued to do some grooming, etc. And it's just, yeah, we were up close and personal.
I guess you were. I mean, that's it. So that, you heard, I think that the observation has been superseded, but the idea that only humans use tools, right? Here's this thing you saw.
Right.
You say, is he going to hit me with that stick, right? And that,
right.
It betrays a level of intelligence and consciousness that humans don't often imagine. We think we're the only ones, but there's other sentient creatures out there. And again, it's like, do we have a right to screw it up for them?
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, so two quick data points to help reinforce that point. One, when we were doing the trekking into the gorillas, they issued us poles, if we didn't already have kind of the hiking poles, et cetera, because you needed them for stability to go down and up, etc. Once we were close, we put our masks on and the poles were left to avoid that implication that we're coming to attack them, right? We did not use poles because of the terrain in the chimpanzee space, but clearly he had the pole in readiness just in case. And obviously it's a similar thing. They only bring us for an hour at a time. You know, and clearly there were guards and guns, etc. So we were not just, you know, folks kind of in street clothes with cameras. Who knows what they were thinking, but he was prepared and he ended up dropping it and, you know, going on.
And you refer to him as a...
I'm assuming it's a him, but
as a, again, you're back to the
idea
of a sentient creature that doesn't look... It's almost like Lord of the Rings stuff, right? Where there's trolls and there are other species that...
Yeah.
And the sort of the preciousness of that is an important takeaway from, I mean, my God, being in the middle of Uganda.
The other tool aspect, periodically in the woods, although more in the savanna type, you see these termite or anthills. And it was told to us, we did not see it specifically, but periodically, especially if they're really hungry, they'll kind of knock off the top of the anthill, take a stick or a reed, and funnel it down through one of the holes, and hopefully when they pick it up, there's all kinds of ants and termites, which they eat. So they will use that tool to go kind of dipping and getting something to eat.
I guess I'm not really sure I want to go too far down that path, but there are, you know, there are, on a climate perspective, I saw somewhere that they're trying to make flour out of insects.
Yes.
I don't want to say what kind of insects, but I mean, there's a long-term future that we may not be that, we share more with these.
We may have to pay more attention to what they're doing and learn from them.
Learn how to feed ourselves going forward.
Yes. Yeah.
So what was your favorite animal?
Favorite animal, I have to say, because I'm of tall stature, if anybody has seen me, I'm 6'2", I love the giraffes.
Really?
I mean,
really?
Respectfully, there's probably a top three. The elephant is certainly there. The lion is certainly there. but the giraffe. The gracefulness of their move. It's amazing to see them. As from little ones to the big ones, a lesson learned along the way. They have colorations, and depending upon the species, the darker the color generally indicates the age of the animal. So the darker the species, or darker the spots on the giraffe, the older that animal is going to be. And you can see that clearly. You've got a smaller one. It's kind of like a very blend. It's almost a blend of the coloring, but clearly they're small. They're the youth. And then the older one, the taller one, is much darker. And it still works when I've got some photos where you see one kind of walking in the open, and in the back, it looks like he's just walking against the bed of trees. And yet you can pick out there's the other head of another one sticking above the tree. Mm-hmm. Their coloring just blends within.
The population is healthy of the giraffe?
Relatively healthy. There was one particular park where they've reintroduced, I think it was 15 giraffes, because for whatever reason they had not been there for some time. But they were fairly healthy in quantities in other parks.
So you went park to park, seven of the 10 major parks, and presumably inside the parks, like in the U.S. national parks, there's not a lot of people living there.
No.
In the spaces between the parks, what was your observation about people's lives? I mean, what did you see?
Yeah, so that gets into kind of the overall economy and lifestyle, or life. Style may be a pejorative term in this case. But Uganda is one of the poorer countries in Africa. 40% are in unemployment. I mean, we worry when it gets to 10 or 12, et cetera. 40% unemployment. 60% of the people, including because there's the 40% unemployed, 60% of the people are living on the equivalent of a buck and a quarter a day. That's not a whole lot of money. Now, granted, they're in a different economy, heavily agrarian, so the little, and there's kind of a hut structure, so they'll start off with kind of a stick-formatted mud hut, right? So they've kind of stick, almost like rebars, and then they have the mud around it.
This is in a rural village,
either in a village or just an off the road. This is an individual's home, and then depending upon the family, there may be multiple, you know, adobes around their vicinity. You know, the families tend to stay together to that extent. Over time, as they gain some more money, they may also take the mud, mix it with cow dung, and then create kind of another layer, more of a finished look, which can then be painted. And we did see some of those. And then you can also do brick formats. And then in the cities, you'll see kind of the concrete block and other, you know, concrete-formed buildings. But the average user, and again, I think roughly 45 million people across the country, approximately half, from what we've understood, are in either Kampala and or the others in major cities.
Very urbanized.
Very well urbanized to that extent, but of the other half, they walk a mile or more to get water. There is no water system other than in some of the major cities. So yeah, their life is very much agrarian, very much, you know, hand to mouth. Their little plots, they'll grow bananas, intermixed with coffee in some cases. Coffee is a co-planting technique that they've been growing, literally expanding the use of. You will occasionally see tea plantations. That's one of their export crops. They do grow watermelons. Mangoes are plentiful. Rice.
So when you say that population has to walk a mile a day to get water, right?
At a minimum. It's a mile out and a mile back.
That touches on the sort of vulnerability to the climate that much of Africa has to climate issues. And just as sort of a level set, context setting, I don't have the exact number, but Africa as a continent contributes very little. Let's just say very little carbon dioxide to the cumulative levels of CO2 in the air, right?
Absolutely.
And it's just no way around it. Africa is not, has not created the climate problem. Yet the entire continent is extremely vulnerable to climate issues.
Absolutely.
And from what I've been able to see, one of the big climate issues in Africa is literally water, in every sense that you can imagine.
Yeah.
Is that there are, as you know, climate change brings more intense storms, more droughts. So you get flooding.
Yeah.
And you get droughts. You get, I mean, one of the terms I saw was rain-dependent agriculture.
Yes.
And so there's no irrigation system. If it doesn't rain,
they don't have water.
You don't have water. The crops don't grow.
Right.
And much of Africa is like, I mean, well, again, it's a big place, but I mean, that's an issue.
Yes.
Right? I saw that the tea trees, you mentioned tea trees, have quite a long lifetime.
Yes.
Tree bush, I guess it is.
Tree bush. Yeah, it's more of a bush.
But they have a long lifetime. And so the bushes that are producing tea, which is an economy, they may or may not survive when the temperatures go up, right? And the question of the urban, and I'll just use the term urbanization, the fact that massive populations are near cities in what are called informal settlements, which is, you say, I mean, it's a place without water, without running water, without sewage, without anything. I mean, it's just, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in this little area. I mean, that's bad enough on a good day, right? But if you say now it's 9,000 degrees and we're all going to flood because there's too much rain, it is a horrific prospect for these areas. And so it's just interesting to hear you say that you saw that.
Yes,
right?
we did see that. And it was one of the dichotomies to the extent that one of the things that astounded me to a certain extent, and we had been in 2019 to Kenya. We had internet there in most places. It was more prevalent in Uganda. I was able to connect to my Verizon.
The internet.
Yeah. I was able to connect with my Verizon device to the internet on a more regular basis. It was like, how does that work? And in the cities, they also have LED solar-powered street lamps, to the extent that they did have street lamps. Not every city had them. But where they did have them, they were LED and solar-powered. So, yeah, in terms of utilizing in the best technology to minimize the impact, et cetera, they had that. And yet, half mile off the road, back to that, you know, mud hut, they're cooking over an open fire because that's all they have. They don't have electricity to take advantage of, say, an induction burner or whatever.
that brings up so many. I mean, one is that the fact that the concept of leapfrogging, right? That the society like that, given the opportunity, doesn't have to put in landlines, doesn't have to build a bunch of transmission lines,
right?
If they have the opportunity, or given the opportunity, but right now, that doesn't exist for. So I saw this thing about the fragile countries in Africa. So there, again, there's a lot of places there that are under stress, right? And when climate comes in and destroys the economy, they can't recover. So then you rewind. We talked about it a few weeks ago, to something called loss and damage.
Yes.
Right? Again, these countries have not done anything to create the climate change problem, but they're going to take the biggest hits.
Yeah.
And the West, that is to say the United States and Europe, are not enthusiastically giving money.
No.
Which is what ultimately needs to happen to make it a viable thing, because then a country like Uganda could, given enough, I mean, I'm just talking off the top of my head, but I mean, given enough solar power, which is relatively easy to install, you could have an induction stove off the, you know, a mile off the road.
Right.
And you can imagine ways to do that. But the circumstance is such that these countries, through history and whatnot, got the short end of the stick here. They have, they're suffering the fault. They've never been able to burn carbon to build an economy, right? And so it must be maddeningly frustrating. In fact, I was listening to a podcast earlier about, it was an of an African voice saying, oh, you know, we should, you know, use less electricity, use less fossil fuels. Like, yeah, but I mean, these guys didn't create the problem. And, and for to be, I mean, the real solution, I guess where I'm headed is this idea that the solution to climate change has to be taken on globally.
Yes.
Right? Because the United States, we can put in solar panels everywhere. There's a lot of people in Africa. I mean, from a moral and practical perspective, we all have to go together.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And so it's just an interesting, I mean, to say you were there, you saw this stuff, the kind of, the I imagine people probably, again, I don't know. I mean, people probably live good, you know, happy enough lives. I mean, happiness and money aren't correlated, but you've got no money.
And they're happy in what they have because they don't know what we have. They don't know the other world. Right. Very few of them really watch TV. They may watch, you know, some videos or TikToks or whatever. Mobile devices, certainly flip phones and the old standard text-based phones. Very few smartphones were out there, at least from what we saw. But the internet also has, they've developed kind of a monetary system where you would have your wallet on your device and you would use that via some menus to pay for this or pay for that to the extent that you've got some funds. And then it begs the question, well, how, if you get an agrarian economy and you sell the corn or the maize or the bananas, how does that money get to your digital wallet? Well, in their economic picture, structure, there's, you know, booths along the way where it's Momo Pay or whatever the different pay. They're like little booths. So you go there, you give them the money, and they effectively make the digital transfer to your wallet. So it's not like you're walking into a bank, but the mobile device services are providing that kind of banking function.
Mm-hmm.
To provide that digital economy to the extent that it exists. And again, there's still
point.
Not
so
a whole lot there.
Leapfrogging that you can have a sophisticated digital economy in a relatively undeveloped place because the technology exists if there's support for it. If this could be probably much more developed with support from the West to rebuild an economy that's sustainable for the future. Fascinating. Well, let me go off on one different rant. you talked about Uganda being a protectorate.
Right? Yes.
So this harkens back to the British Empire.
Yes.
Right? Which, and we all know the British Empire, but the sun never sets on the British Empire, right? It was Australia, India, much of Africa, parts of South America. Colonial colonies, when you look it up, it's basically a process by which a more powerful country extracts value from a less powerful country.
Yes.
Often through violence and oppression, right? And so that's the history of colonies. Yeah. Having been one, we have a little experience with that, right? Colonialism is still an existing thing. A lot of the circumstance of these countries in Africa and many places around the world is because of a colonial heritage where the value was extracted.
Right.
Right. And, we spoke before. I mean, King Leopold's Ghost is a book about the King of Belgium who basically had a colony in Congo extracting rubber just at the time, by the way, of the first bicycle boom when rubber tires for bicycles were made. But it was a horrifically violent time, and all the value of those rubber trees went out of the country. The Congo didn't get it. Belgium got it.
Right.
So similar things around the world have left many parts of the world impoverished, and that continues now. They're vulnerable to climate because of the history. But I think there's a different way to think of it as well, is that we've touched on in a previous show how even today, there's something in Africa called the East Africa Crude Oil Pipeline.
Yes.
ECOP, yep. Right, which is a French and Chinese oil companies that want to build a pipeline through basically the heart of Africa,
mm-hmm.
right? And this is a wildly destructive thing.
Well, to the extent that Uganda is landlocked, you've got to get it to the coast some way, and that's effectively what they're attempting to do. One of the parks that we went to, coincidentally, was on, I believe it was either the Sunday or the Monday, it was the Chinese New Year. There was a busload of Chinese workers celebrating on their day off, visiting the park, and they're working on one of these Chinese-sponsored projects. Because, yeah, to extract the resources, it requires money. So China has been forthcoming, at least in Uganda. There was presence in a number of places, but we've seen it in other countries, and certainly there are other opportunities there. We've talked about, the battery supplies and other extracts. Uganda is relatively rich in resources, and the one resource that they still maintain, and I'll go back to kind of in that protectorate, they're very mindful of controlling their own destiny. The people themselves are amazing. Absolutely amazing. They're very much like us. They have the same wishes and dreams, not on the scale clearly that US has, mm-hmm. because they're not born in our zip codes.
Mm-hmm.
They're born in, next to the tree out in the forest, et cetera. Mm-hmm. There's a different world. And yet they still want good things for their kids. They still want to have good things for their family. They still want to have fun. I mean, that's all. That's the humanness of it.
Yeah. I mean, and I think of it more politically, since I didn't experience it quite so personally. But I mean, it's the idea that a countries in Africa, their economic wealth is on extracting the value of the resources in their country for use by other people.
Yes.
Is like a fundamental unfairness that you don't really put into words very often. I was listening to a podcast about, and I think it was from Nigeria. I mean, the guy was saying that Nigeria has enough oil in its country to power itself for 270 years.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But all that oil is getting taken out and sent overseas. Right? And they're left with the remaining junk, the pollution and whatnot.
Right.
And so we're back to this concept of colonialism as a vocabulary to talk about what happens in places like Africa, where the resources are extracted for the benefit of someone else and not for the benefit of the people in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes back to the question of how, from a world governance perspective, how are we going to solve these problems mm-hmm. that we all face mutually? I mean, the other sort of other way to colonial concept, I think, that's worth throwing out is that America is colonizing in the sense of we take our carbon pollution. Right? We run our cars, we run our society, we're fat, dumb, and happy, we got money, everything's great. We take our pollution and put it in the air, and it goes away. Where does it go? It goes over Africa.
Right? It goes around the world.
We are occupying, we are colonizing the air over the rest of the world with our effluent, right? And we're not going to pay for that, right? No one's going to... And so these concepts of... I mean, colonialism is a funny way to talk about it, and I'm no expert, but it is a way to think about how climate change is connected to these other, has continuity with these other concepts that have floated around for a long time, from mm-hmm. the American colonies.
Right.
And you just see it, you see it playing out in Africa. And I guess the point I'm trying to make is that, maybe I've already made it, but it's like... We can't solve the climate change problem in America alone.
No.
Right?
No.
It is a global issue.
Absolutely.
And that the things we've touched on before, the United Nations providing monies to other countries so that they can catch up in a clean way, is an imperative if we want to solve the problem. Because mm-hmm. if we don't, then, if Nigeria says we're not going to send our oil to anyone else, we're going to burn it for the next 200 years, okay, that's not a great solution either.
No.
Right? So
no.
Morally and practically, we all have to go I mean, there's a famous, not famous, but what I was told was an African sort of proverb of saying, if you want to go fast, go alone.
Yes.
If you want to go far, go together. Right.
Correct. I've used that a few times myself. It is true. Yes.
I mean, we have a long way to go, and mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah. And back to the people side, and another proverb, because it comes to mind as well, but their aspects of the world, you know, I mean, I'm sitting here struggling with kind of the justice of it all. We have so much we're benefiting from, and yet they don't. And don't have a realistic chance of getting something like it. And yet, the sun will rise tomorrow. Is one of their beliefs, mm-hmm. right? So mm-hmm. one of the pieces that, and I haven't gone to double check, but through Kenya and then Uganda as well, we found that, and I think I've got a picture that I'll definitely share. So it was kind of like the High Life Motel. You know, it's kind of a gated structure. You got a nice formal gate. 4-story building. 2 stories are complete, windowed, they're occupied. The other 2 stories above are still in the process of construction. They've got some scaffolding, some pieces, etc. Apparently one of the tax pieces is that you only are taxed upon the finished part of the building. So even though the land is occupied and you've got maybe 4 stories, only 2 are being used, so you're taxed on the 2 that are used. Not taxed until you get to the 3rd use or the 4th use, which is one of those conundrums to the extent that, well, you need money in order to build the infrastructure, but if you don't get enough money, then, I mean, right. you're in this kind of never-ending circle. Thing, yeah. It's like, how are you going to resolve that?
Right.
Coming back to kind of the economic justice of it, and yet they're happy. The sun will rise tomorrow.
And I think it's a lesson that, I mean, climate change will require... Addressing climate change will require changes in how we live our lives.
Yes.
Right? And I think in many ways, the West is the group that is in the fantasy land.
Yes.
That we can go on with this sort of destructive way forever.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to grow forever and ever. Everything's going to be good. And I think that the change has to come from people like us who say that, people in the West who are willing to accept not less of a lifestyle, but that the sun will come up tomorrow.
Right.
If you don't have a Ford F-150 that you can't see the ground from, you can't see a small child from the driver's seat, right? I mean, life goes on, and you can have a good life without being so destructive.
Mm-hmm.
And so how you build that in a context of America, right, which is a sophisticated place and not,
mm-hmm.
But right. I mean, the idea that the sun will come up is an important one, because it does say that all of the things you think you can't live without, not necessarily true.
No.
Right?
No. I think the one question I would come back to that, if anything, would at least start fostering the change, many people, and again, it's a generalization, obviously, we don't necessarily think of the implications of our actions. But if we took that longer view, you know, going back to say the 150 as opposed to a hybrid, what is the longer view? You can still get transportation, but, you know, the 150 versus the hybrid is certainly a choice. There's monetary value, there's that long-term value, the climate value, the carbon capture, the carbon tax. I mean, we're running our economy, going back to what we've talked about, without really accounting for the carbon impacts. And if that's going to be one of those struggles, that if we start doing that, it's going to be some significant changes. And how are we going to get there?
Can I throw a vocabulary word out there? I mean, that's the in an economics perspective, what you just referred to is called, I believe, externalities.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, when you buy a tank of gas to drive your car, your Ford F-150 around, you are not paying for the damage it's caused. That's external to the transaction, and the person who pays for the damage is some poor guy in Africa, mm-hmm. right, who's not part of your little closed deal between you and ExxonMobil,
right?
Right, and so you hear about when we talk about carbon taxes or fees, it's basically trying to bring that external cost that is not considered.
Kind of widening the circle of influence.
Well, I mean, who's in the transaction?
Who's in the transaction? Considering some of those secondary, tertiary sources as part of it.
Those other parties that are not party to the immediate thing. So somebody
Correct.
In Africa is party to your
right.
purchase of gasoline, mm-hmm. and they should get some benefit. Now, what is the benefit? The benefit of having an external price, putting the pricing in that externality, as they say, it raises the price of gasoline. You don't use as much, and mm-hmm. so you've got a price signal and blah 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 blah. But you're right. But we don't take into account the implications and the cost of the things that we do. And until we get around to doing that, either from a sort of personal, moral, you know, vision, or through an economic price signal that says it's going to cost you more to drive that F-150. I'm beating up on F-150.
Mm-hmm.
I hope you don't have an F-150.
No, I don't. I have a hybrid.
But, I mean, you know, as a society, when you get on an airplane, there's an input. There's an external partner to that
that
is not part of the transaction.
No,
so.
No.
It's a fascinating thing.
It is. It is. And I'm very grateful for having had the opportunity. Coley, I don't go very often.
Yeah.
I'm not planning on necessarily going back to Uganda.
The
but
of the privilege to do these things.
Yes.
Right? The privilege to get, I've made the case, like 90% of the mankind is never going to get on an airplane.
Nope.
Right? Place to begin is to recognizing that you have that, right, and being
starting
grateful
that.
For that.
Absolutely.
That you are in a, me too, right? I've been mm-hmm. on, you're in this blessed position, and the sooner you begin to appreciate how blessed you are, it makes it easier to comprehend mm-hmm. the position that other people are in, how
totally.
They might be feeling, or what they
right.
see as the the world, their worldview.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, bottom line, it certainly helped me in my other role in terms of citizen reporting, citizen journalism. I've certainly been exposed to a different set of citizenry and a different life how they do things. Now I can't unsee that. It informs what I will be doing going forward,
Absolutely.
Hopefully for the better.
I mean, it is, I echo... I mean, I've been to Japan. First time I came back from Japan, I said, oh, my God, this is like an alternate reality. This is like going through Alice through the Looking Glass,
mm-hmm.
right? There's this whole other world.
Right.
It's the same, but it's different, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so you go to Africa, you say,
sure.
It informs how you see your own existence, and you, again, recognize how what you have is different. You appreciate it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Travel is broadening. To
Travel is definitely broadening. We can bring it back.
Speaking of travel, I love to travel, right? But what I've been doing, and I have to do a podcast on this, I have been traveling in the age of climate, where it does cost, there are externalities to
mm-hmm.
flying to.
Sure.
I've been using YouTube to ride along the Silk Road in China.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And there are all these videos where you can tour any city that you want, and some guy just puts a GoPro on his head and he walks around for 2 hours, and you get to see Baluchistan.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's an interesting question as to whether or not that sort of travel is as broadening as actually being there. But in the age of climate change, where it's going to get more and more pricey to be flying to Baluchistan,
right.
the digital technology allows you to have some of these experiences, which
Absolutely.
Are broadening.
Yeah. In parallel, I think, and we've talked whether climate or otherwise, certainly coming out of COVID, when you're isolated and you have to remote and just deal with Zoom, you can still work. You can still do business. Having been in a corporate environment, multiple corporate environments, I always found it beneficial to have built a relationship with the individuals in person before we ended up going online. You can do it online. It just takes longer to get that kind of relationship that you can develop, you know, over the water cooler, hanging over the corner, coffee, etc., that is so much quicker and easier in person. It can still happen, but it just takes time.
So now we're really off-fantasizing. But I mean, it's like I read this book called Ministry for the Future.
About two-thirds of the way through.
In it, the main protagonist has to go from Switzerland to San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And the description is of a train to, like, Bordeaux and then a sailboat to the U.S. All the time she is working on her computer. So she's plugged in, Zooming.
Right.
But the reason I say that is that you can make these long distance business trips might take hours longer, but you can get there and be effective. It's just that you're not going to do it you don't have to do it in a day.
No.
And I come back to my question.
Absolutely.
I keep asking,
yep,
if you can't go to Beijing in 10 hours, does the sun stop coming up? I would say the sun's still going to come up. You're going to do business somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And there are ways to do it in the modern technology.
Yeah.
Now, we're a long way from Uganda right now, so I should back up.
Yes. Yeah, we'll come back to the studio here in Franklin, where hopefully if you're still following us and you haven't turned off somewhere along the way, you may have learned a little bit more about some of the kind of real-world impacts of whether it's travel, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, and climate as a general aspect of life and what we're going to be changing and considering as we go forward. So thanks for spending some time today.
It was fascinating to hear of your experience. It really seems like a profoundly important and life-changing or memorable thing for you. And God bless you.
Lots of memories. There's more writing, more video, more stuff to come. But this is kind of like the short story version of the quick recap, because I'm still kind of adjusting. We've been back a week. And it's good to be back. It's good to have been away to get that perspective, to thoroughly appreciate being back.
That's great.
Well, thank you again. And for the listeners, we do this because Franklin matters. We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. By the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.